go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Noel Brown, nicknames TBA. Although, by just as an aside, Scott, we did have a really interesting conversation with Dylan, who is rereading some history of Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And it inspired him to make some very specific nickname propositions and references to us.
Yeah, what brought that about? Now, we had given him a nickname in a previous episode, a couple of episodes ago.
Yeah.
That he somehow... Oh, no, I know what it was. I've got it now. This is kind of funny. The power was out one night when I had to approve one of our episodes. And I told him that I was... It was a late night email that I had to send because I was approving this thing until after midnight some night. But the power had gone out earlier in the night at our house. So I had a candle there by the laptop, reviewing this file. And I said, I kind of feel like, this must be how Abraham Lincoln approved his podcast back in the day, by candlelight in the log cabin. And he thought that was pretty funny, but he added his own little spin on it and gave us some Lincoln-associated nicknames.
Yeah, and we complimented him on these because his history references were amazing, and he said that he was – actually, I'll just read this part from him.
Oh, sure.
So he said, your history references are great and pretty funny, and Dylan said – thanks, guys. I've just been rereading Team of Rivals and saw an opportunity for references, much like Salmon P. Chase saw an opportunity to introduce the nation's first paper currency during his time as Lincoln's Secretary of Treasury.
Oh, nice fact drop in there.
This guy is, like, absorbing knowledge at an insane rate.
It makes me scared of him.
You know, I feel like if he ever became a brainiac overlord of some sort...
Yeah.
He'd be really cool about it.
I think you're probably right.
He would be such a laid-back, easy-going dictator.
Agreed.
So, Dylan for president.
Oh, man, don't say that. Okay, man. Okay, so maybe we should get into today's topic. How about that?
That's right. We are putting our asides aside and jumping straight to the topic for the day. And this one is... This one has a little bit of a personal slant for me.
Really? A personal interest? What do you mean?
Well, as you know, Scott, I live it sounds bad when I say it this way, but hear me out. I live in an abandoned car factory.
Oh, that's
actually
right.
I live in what we call the Ford factory. It's not abandoned now. They turned it into, apartments.
You're not just like camping out in a corner
somewhere? Not just like squatting under a 67 hood or something.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot. So two historic buildings side by side. You live in one. You work in one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in the one that you were in, what did they make there? I think it was Model A's. Is that right?
Yeah. Model A's.
Ford Model A's.
Model A's too.
Oh, Model T's came out of there.
Yeah. Well, it was just... So we're right by a series of train tracks, right?
Yeah.
Now they have been converted to like a walking path, but the train tracks used to run between these two buildings.
Yeah.
And the buildings were built alongside the tracks so that they could easily transport large industrial items like, appliances or, in my case, automobiles.
Yeah. Worked out perfect.
And it made me think because... It made me think back to some of the discussions we had had before about how difficult it is to start a car company, right? Mm-hmm. And the enormous cost in terms of in terms of money, but also in terms of time that are involved in this sort of endeavor. And you having a storied history in Detroit, in Michigan, you know just how big these things are. And a lot of people who have never seen an automotive factory have no idea about just the sheer scale. These things are huge.
Yeah, we're talking about millions of square feet of space, of floor space in these things, and they occupy hundreds of acres of property. So they're really, really enormous. And the thing is, in their heyday, in their prime, these are fine-tuned machines. They crank out the product. Of course, it's the people making it all happen, but the machines as well. All of it working together in harmony to make everything work just right. And it's a fine-tuned machine.
Mm-hmm.
When the industry goes away, when the company moves out, when the place becomes empty,
right.
If it's not immediately handed over to somebody else to become, you know, some new, money making venture for them.
Sure.
Oftentimes they become derelict very fast. It doesn't take long before, you know, people come in to take out the metal, you know, to scrap the metal.
Right.
They start breaking the windows. They start living in there. They start squatting in there when they're not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
Unlike you. You were supposed to be where you are.
I am paying somebody rent. I hope they own the place.
well, that counts.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, there's fires, there's, outside there, typically it's, just kind of run down, of course, the landscaping and everything goes to hell. And they just look really bad almost immediately. It doesn't take more than about a year for a factory to start to look like it's an abandoned factory. And it is abandoned, but to start looking like it's abandoned.
Yeah. And so this all brings us to our topic today, which is abandoned car factories. What happens when these giants of industry close shop and, shut the doors, soap up the windows? And this will also be of interest to urban explorers. We got a lot of urban explorers who listen to Car Stuff and other How Stuff Works podcast, and one of these buildings might be near you.
There's a good chance, because they're all around the world, the ones we're going to talk about today. So just so you're aware, we're following along with a list that came from Jalopnik, and we're going to add a couple maybe at the end here, some that we have some experience with, I guess, maybe. But these are the 10 most unbelievable abandoned car factories, according to Jalopnik's or Jalopnik listeners, or readers, I should say, rather, because they wrote in with these suggestions. So here's the thing with this, though, Ben, is a lot of these have links that you can follow. They go to other articles that have just a wealth of information and photos and everything. So I encourage you, if you want to, follow along with this list from Jalopnik, or at least check it out after this podcast.
Yeah.
And look at some of these links. Look at some of the photos of the things that we'll describe. We'll just give you kind of a rundown of the top 10 that they have.
Mm-hmm.
See if you agree. Maybe add some of your own. Think about, factories in your area that you might also add to this list.
Mm-hmm.
Car factories in particular.
Right.
Have to be car factories. And it's just fascinating to see what happens and how quickly it happens. And just, the idea that, the locals all have an idea of what happened there and that's prime, but now it's gone. The town kind of dried up or whatever. So they all got their own story. Let's start with number 10, which is the DeLorean plant in Dunmurry, Ireland.
And this guy, John DeLorean, keeps showing up in podcasts lately. Have you noticed that?
Yes, I have.
He was here last week, too.
Yeah, strange.
This, as Scott said, is in Dunmurry, Ireland. We are talking about the factory responsible for the manufacture of one of the easily top five most iconic cars in film.
Yeah, the DMC-12, the sports car that DeLorean built. And that started to happen. Remember, he had a long history with, Packard and then General Motors, and then went off to do his own thing. And by 1975, he had founded something called the DeLorean Motor Company. And again, he was headquartered in Michigan, but this factory, the place that he was going to build this, was in Ireland. And that's kind of a rarity, too, by the way. There's not a lot of cars manufactured in Ireland. DeLorean was one of them.
Right.
There was another one I posted recently on St. Patrick's Day. There's actually a car built there called the Shamrock that I find unusual. But again, the DeLorean Motor Company was around from 1975 until about 1982 when it went bankrupt. We did a podcast, an entire podcast on DeLorean.
Yes.
And that was back in February of 2010. I think there was a rerun a little bit later on that you can catch as well. But go back to February 2010 to hear a full podcast on all, that was all about John DeLorean and his car and his dream. And I guess this factory is really something else to see. But the main part of this factory that you want to check out if you're there is the track. There's an abandoned test track that looks pretty haunted, as a matter of fact. It looks a little spooky.
Yeah. There's there are different things that are, I guess you could say, ruins or vestiges of the factory's heyday. The test track is by far, the most visible, noticeable thing, and you can get there. I mean, you can get there. We're not going to comment on the legality.
Oh, yeah.
We're certainly not going to advocate breaking the law.
Well, as the article says, you got to jump many fences to see this test track.
But if you happen to see it, you'll also see that there's an alloy wheel factory on part of the property, and that you can still find moldings and cast off components, but you know they've fallen victim to the elements, right?
Yeah, and we know what happened to the machines.
And we know what happened to the machines.
If you want to find out, check out that podcast.
Yep, you will have to check it out. Shameless plug, carstuffshow.com. Here's one of the things I think is most interesting about the DeLorean plant. Apparently, it had separate entrances for Catholic and Protestant workers. Did you read that?
Yeah, I didn't look for photos of it. You know, I read about it, but I didn't, you know, seek out and see if I could, you know, actually spot, you know, where the two doors were side by side. But there's a similar thing in I guess Mason history, right? Or not Mason history. What do you want to call it? Mason culture.
Masonry,
culture, maybe. Mm-hmm. In that they have separate doors oftentimes for Scottish Rite bodies and York Rite bodies, and they're labeled as such. So, you know, this separate door idea is not entirely new, but it's interesting that it was there at the factory.
So check it out if you have a chance. Send us some pictures. I don't know if that test track is drivable, but you could probably walk on it.
Maybe walk on it.
Yeah. Our next thing is, so we're talking about the size. This will help us underline the enormity of these things. They are in many instances, car factories are as large as small towns.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Buick City. And now Buick City is in Flint, Michigan, or it was in Flint, Michigan. And this is on 235 acres. And, of course, you know, this is a huge auto manufacturing facility or complex, I should say. It was owned by General Motors in Flint, Michigan from 1904 until about 2010 when they finally completely closed it off. Of course, it was used for Buick production. I mean, the term Buick City wasn't really coined until about 1985. The final cars that were built there were the Pontiac Bonneville and the Buick LeSabre. But there's a wide range of vehicles that were built there over that, you know, the many, many decades that it was open. This is one of the largest factories in the world at one time. So there were 24 separate buildings that were on this, you know, 235-acre plot of land. And until 1928, I think it was, when the Rouge River plant opened up, you know, Ford Rouge River plant, it was the largest factory or automobile factory of its kind, of its time.
Yeah, yeah. And people noticed in the area, Scott had earlier mentioned how all the locals will have, in many cases, a very personal relationship with these buildings, with these structures and these sites. And in this area of mid-Michigan, a lot of people see the closure of the GM or of Buick City as this catalyst or this turning point, this tipping point in the history of the area.
Yeah, well, so many people were employed by this factory. I mean, generations of families had been, you know, workers at this factory from the very beginning in some cases. So when something like that dries up, of course it's going to have an impact on the city that, you know, it surrounds this thing, that is built up because of this thing, really. So the good news is, I guess, in this case, you know, now it's just this great big this isn't good news, but it's surrounded by barbed wire and fence, and it's a big flat piece of concrete now. You know, they completely knocked it down, the whole 200 plus acres. But the American Cast Iron Pipe Company has announced plans to build a 200,000 square foot facility on the same property. So I hope that plan goes through it, you know, as they hope it will, as they've drawn it out, because Flint could definitely use some revitalization at this point. So moving on to number 8 on the list is the Fisher Body Plant in Detroit, Michigan. And this is a really interesting one, Ben, because well, they're all really interesting, but this one in particular, because this one has a long history with a lot of different companies. It's not just General Motors, as you might think. So the Fisher Body Plant in Detroit, there's a specific one in Detroit that we're talking about, is the one on Piquette Avenue, on St. Antoine and Piquette. And this is an Albert Kahn designed building. Now, it was built in, I think it was around 1919, but Albert Kahn is an American industrial architect, and he was said to be the premier architect of the time, the guy that you wanted to design your building. He's often called the architect of Detroit. So he has his hand in a lot of the buildings that we'll talk about today on this list. And so this building that, you know, was built in 1919 is just one of many buildings that that Fisher Body had owned. At one point, they owned 40 buildings with a total of 3.7 million square feet of floor space. So this is kind of like the final remaining piece in that puzzle. This building, of course, is it's well, this company, I should say, Fisher Body, is a coach building company. So it dates all the way back to, you know, wooden bodies on cars.
Right, right. Back when you would essentially just buy an engine and maybe a chassis.
Yeah, yeah, and then have a custom body added onto that. Now, it wasn't just, you know, individuals that were coming to them for bodies. It was also manufacturers. And I said it wasn't just General Motors as well, because we associate this typically with General Motors cars. But, you know, that iconic Body by Fisher logo, and a lot of people know that logo, that was actually applied to GM door sills until about the mid-1990s. So that hung on a long, long time. But the companies that came to them over the years, there were companies that were like Abbott and Buick and Cadillac and Chalmers and Ford and Hudson, Studebaker, Regal. There's a long, long list. And that's only a couple of the many, many companies that would come to them for body work.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a it's just it's an iconic building. It is a it's a piece of history. It's something that a lot of people would like to see, you know, remain standing or used in some way. But the problem is it's in a not so great part of Detroit right now. And it's definitely fallen apart. It's covered with graffiti. The windows are all broken out. You can look at the photo online. I think it's actually a street view that you can get online. So you can kind of go all the way around the building and take a look at, you know, what's left around it. It looks like a lot of vacant property around it as well. So bad news for the Fisher Body plant, but hopefully it'll turn into something good.
And we know what you are thinking, ladies and gentlemen, possibly. Scott and I are using our amazing podcast telepathy powers to figure out that some of you are going, oh man, this is going to be depressing and it's going to be so heavy on Michigan. Just wait, because we're going to take a break for a word from our sponsors and then we're traveling to New York.
And we're back. And Ben, you said we were going to take a trip to New York for number 7 on our list. Is that right?
Yes, sir. That is correct. And they had a slight mention earlier when we were talking about Fisher. We are looking at the Studebaker building in New York City.
Yeah. Now, the current owner of this is Columbia University. And here's the thing with this. This is located at 615 West 131st Street between Broadway and 12th Avenue. And this is the former Studebaker automobile finishing plant, which, you know, they have this giant freight elevator within this property, you'll see, was constructed in 1923 as brick construction with white porcelain trim, which I find really cool. It's 6 stories tall, so it's a big building. Again, take a look at the photos, and you'll see this white porcelain trim on the outside top edges and along, looks like maybe, I don't know if that's an elevator shaft or if that is a smokestack, but really, really cool. And I think you can even see a bit of a logo that they used, a blue logo that's still visible near the top corner of the building from back in like the 1920s, 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
But really, really cool building. It's a real solid building, and it was sold in 1937, I think, to the Borden Milk Company, which used it as a milk processing plant for a while.
And then it became a storage space, essentially, for the American Museum of Natural History. Then it had been offices, a couple of small manufacturing facilities, and even at one time, a doll company.
A doll company. That's a strange move, huh? Now, I mean, I guess they need a lot of space, but you know what? The time in this thing's life, of course, I'd love to see it when they're making product, you know, and then one of the photos here is them making, you know, the U.S. Postal Service Jeeps. You know,
right.
the real boxy ones, the blue and white ones.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool assembly line shot there. But I think the time that I would have liked to have seen this the most outside of the production would have been when they were the American Museum of Natural History storage facility. Can you imagine what they would put in something like that?
I'm always so curious.
That would be really neat to walk around and just see what they stuff out of the way, you know, when it's not on display.
It's like the most interesting episode of Hoarders ever.
Also pretty spooky, right? Wouldn't it be spooky to see that? Yeah. So I think it's now back to office spaces again because somewhere in the 1980s someone bought the building. So, and one other thing we should mention here, and this is not in New York, but it's kind of a tangentially related thing, and they have a link to it that I followed, and I've seen this before. There's something called – this is Studebaker related, by the way.
Okay.
There's something called Bendix Park. Now, it's spelled B-E-N-D-I-X, and you know, as in the auto parts manufacturer, Bendix Woods, and – this is actually in – it's not in New York again. It's in New Carlisle, Indiana, but it's near the Studebaker test track. And if you look at the aerial photos of that area, you'll see the test track. And then just off to the side, you're going to find an area called, again, Bendix Park that has 5,000 trees that spell out the word Studebaker that you can read from above. So if you're flying
Weird.
Overhead, you can see this. And they've restored it recently. For a while, it was kind of, you know, a few trees had died out and it didn't quite spell out the full word. You know, there were missing parts of the letters.
Yeah.
They've restored it so that now it clearly reads Studebaker once again. But really, really cool thing to check out, you know, the aerial photos or Google Earth or whatever you want to do. But again, that's New Carlisle, Indiana. You can spot it online pretty mm-hmm. easy. The next one on the list is going all the way to Italy. We're going international, Ben.
We're going international. We finally made it, Scott. We are traveling, in fact, to the Alfa Romeo Portello plant in Milano.
Yeah, this one was opened in 1908, and it was an 86,111 square foot factory. And it was around until about 2004 when it was finally demolished. But the real story here, Ben, is the photographs that we saw before it was demolished. The factory workers that left there, whenever they walked out finally, whenever it was the final straw for this factory, they left a mess behind. The bulldozers ended up just kind of covering it all up. We'll never know what was really lost here outside of what we could see in those photos. No one went in to save all the stuff that was there. There were cars that were unbuilt there.
Yeah.
There were usable machines, you know, usable factory machines that were still there. There were half-finished prototypes that were still on the property. Of course, lots of papers and things that had, you know, been stored in offices for who knows what. I mean, it could have been future product. It could have been anything, really. It could have been nothing. Could have been something. But, again, we'll just never know. We'll never know what was lost in this situation.
Yeah, fortunately.
Yeah, and I think it's now, you know, because it's been raised and, you know, mm-hmm. they made something new on the property. So now I think it's like a residential and commercial property or, you know, something like a mixed-use area. But again, that original factory is gone. And there's some great photographs of what it was like then. And you just can't believe the stuff. And they're overturned prototypes in the factory.
Yeah, just laying there.
Yeah, laying there underneath, looks like an inch of dust. Just grime and stuff thrown everywhere, packing materials. It's really a shame to see the way they left the factory behind like that. But, again, lost to history.
And while we are in Europe, let's make our way over to Birmingham, England, the site of the Longbridge plant.
Yeah, sometimes called the Longbridge MG Rover factory. And this one is still there. You can still go check this one out. But in this factory, they said that when this factory shut down, it was almost like it killed the British car industry itself because there were a lot of stuff made there. There was the Austins, Nash Metropolitans, mm-hmm. British Leyland products, and finally the MG Rover. I think Morris cars were built there. Just a lot of product came out of the Longbridge plant in Birmingham, England.
And there's really controversial issue with this because one thing that surprised a lot of people was that at the time of its closure, the Longbridge plant was incredibly outdated. Mm-hmm. They had stuff that their assembly line was probably modern in the 1950s, maybe, and they still used a drop-in to put the body and powertrain together. The modernization and investment that would have had to happen to the plant was apparently something that the government who owned the plant was not very interested in.
Yeah, I think I read a note that said they were more the emphasis was more on getting people employed there. They're trying to work on getting people in and having them work rather than updating the facility. And you got to have kind of a good balance of this, right? You have to spend money on the facility itself as well as the people inside. And now I understand the thought process behind both, but there has to be kind of a happy mix here. You know, something that allows them to keep up with the Joneses, maybe, and the Joneses being other car producing countries, really.
Yeah.
Is that a good way to put that? I don't know if that's a fair way to put that, really.
Well, it's a tricky balance.
It is. I mean, the task was, you know, to get this building up to spec so that, you know, it was a little bit more modern, as well as employ, you know, as many people as they possibly could, you know, because it's good for the economy, local economy. But I don't know. Maybe I'm digging a little too deep on this one. We should probably just let it go. But but the idea was that, you know, either way, they left a lot of unfinished cars behind, and it was way outdated. And it's a sad day when this one closed down.
Yes. And, Scott, remember how earlier we said, you know, this wasn't going to be all Michigan. it's still going to be a lot of Michigan.
Well, that's because there are just so many. I mean,
right.
I guess per capita, there's so many factories there. And one of these, the Packard plant in Detroit, Michigan. Oh my gosh, Ben! This just continually bad news out of the Packard plant, really.
Right.
There are moments where you get just a little bit of hope, but then it's dashed. So this is a plant that was opened in 1911. I think the building, the construction of this started a few years prior to that. It's a huge facility. Again, 3.5 million square feet. And this is all one property. Distinguished, I guess, by this main bridge that goes across between factory buildings for the product to travel between them. Just it has been abused over the years. I don't know officially when this thing shut down. I don't remember exactly the day, but I will tell you that over the past several decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I was there, it was already abandoned.
Yeah.
It's fallen prey to metal scrappers and people. I'm one who did this. I played paintball there because there was a company that had set up paintball. Operation, I guess.
That sounds pretty fun.
In the main offices. It was a lot of fun, but now looking back, and I don't know.
Do you feel like you were dancing on a grave?
I don't know. I don't know how to feel about it because it's disrespectful. Yeah, but I mean,
but
look where it is now. It's not any better now, 22 years later. So this was the mid-1990s when I'm playing paintball in there.
Yeah.
But urban explorers, photographers, of course, just crazy stuff happens here. If you want to see some crazy, I'm going to say it, crazy ass stuff, Ben, happens at this plant. Did you know that there was an escaped tiger that was there in 2015?
No, for how long?
For just for a day. But a British photographer had set up this photo shoot there because it's like an urban ruin area.
Right, right.
Very, very popular with photographers. So this guy sets up the shoot with a tiger, a Siberian tiger, and I guess there were like naked models on site and everything. It was kind of a crazy shoot, right?
Yeah.
And this tiger escapes. It gets onto the fourth floor staircase of one of these buildings, and they don't know what to do. So they call on this guy. There's a story in a local paper, I think, from this guy in 2015 who was called by a friend, and he said, hey, do you know anything about these? Can you somehow – I don't know if he's an animal handler or what, but they called him. And he said he had no tools with him. He had a weed whacker and a tarp, and he came over and they caught this tiger. Now, can you believe that?
Yeah.
It's crazy.
That's insane. I'm glad the tiger's okay.
There's video of this happening. It's not like it's some tall tale. It really happened. There's a tiger in the Packard factory in 2015. In 2009, there was a dump truck that was famously pushed out of a fourth floor window. And that's on video. It's really cool to watch. But again, vandals. That's vandals.
I don't know, man. Maybe the dump truck deserved it.
Come on. The mystery is, like, how did it get on the fourth floor to begin with?
Right.
Because it's a full-size dump truck. But to watch it plummet out of the fourth floor, it's impressive and it's kind of fun. But, again, they shouldn't have done it. They weren't allowed to be on the property.
A couple things we do have to emphasize about this.
All right.
This is the largest abandoned factory of its kind. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned that 3.5 million square feet, 35 acres. And what's weird about this is – in some ways, and this is a little abstract here, so go with me. Go with me, and then keep me in check if I'm getting too weird with it. In some ways, this factory kind of continued after it closed, but in a very strange way, because once it was liquidated, the pre-war designs and the tooling were sold to other parties around the world, behind the Iron Curtain and stuff. So. In Russia, they were building Packard clones using the same stuff. So it's almost like they just moved the factory or pieces of it, and they were under the Zil and Zim nameplates. And these designs lasted well into the 70s.
So I guess what we're getting at then is that this is like the skeleton of the company, really. It's not so much that we're desecrating the Packard name, because that really had gone away with the machines and the product and all the other materials. This is more like this is like what's left behind that should have probably been knocked down a long time ago, but hasn't been. In fact, Ben, one last quick thing about this, crazy this place is.
Yeah.
And honestly, this is the tip of the iceberg. The fire department doesn't show up to fires that are lit on that property anymore. There was a story many years ago, now I'm going to say 4 or 5 years ago, that they were so frequently called to the Packard plant in Detroit that, for a fire, somewhere in the factory property, that they eventually decided that they were wasting too much time with fires on this property and they could just burn themselves out. So they don't even bother showing up anymore to the fires.
That's
insane. How do you like that? That's crazy. This place is enormous. You've got to see it in order to believe it. And it was sold in 2013 to a Texan doctor who bought it for like $6 million.
Wow.
And he was supposed to pay the back taxes. I don't think he ever did pay the back taxes. So I don't know what's going on with it. But again, it's a crazy place. A lot of really weird stuff happens there.
And we're going to get even weirder after a word from our sponsors. And we're back. We are still staying in Michigan for now. We are going to Highland Park Ford Plant.
Yeah, this is the last one on our list from Michigan, and the top two are elsewhere. But this is a Ford factory. Now, this is actually the first Model T production facility. So imagine this. This is where the first assembly line was introduced, you know, where the minimum wage was introduced.
Right, where the minimum wage is introduced, where our favorite madman savant himself, Henry Ford, plays a crucial role in the invention of what we recognize as the weekend.
Yeah.
And this is one of the hearts of American history.
Now, thankfully, this place was put on the National Historic Register being a National Historic Landmark in 1978. So it's been protected ever since. I think there's always kind of that danger that the property is going to be sold or that the factory is going to be, raised in some way. But at least most of it, because it's a pretty big building. It's a huge factory. Again, it's another Albert Kahn design. We've mentioned him many times. This is built around 1910. And if you're driving down Woodward Avenue in Michigan sometime, you can see this place. I think it's being used for storage right now. It's you can see the boxes piled up in the windows, and you can find the doorways that you used to see those old, the grainy film footage of, the Model Ts rolling out one by one, super fast.
Yeah.
You can see those doors in place. You can peek in through holes in the doors that, you can see the remnants of the first assembly line there. It's really remarkable. It's an interesting building. I hope it never goes away, but I also hope they do something with it because it's fallen into disrepair over the last, I'd say, 20 years maybe. I've been there several times. Nearby or right next door, there's a place called the Model T Plaza, which is just a strip mall. But if you want to see the factory itself, you can still go down there and see that and read the historic mark and plaque, rather, and look around for those doors that I mentioned. It's just a neat place.
Yeah, but it's not the weirdest.
Not the weirdest, and not the weirdest by Ford as well.
Yeah, right. So let's stay with Ford, but let's go to Brazil. In Santarém, Brazil, Fordlandia was built by Henry himself with the idea that, as we've mentioned before on this show, with the idea that he could sort of integrate rubber production and own his own rubber plantation.
And his own community. So that's the strange part about this is. This is in the rainforest, right?
Yeah, and it's a whole city.
It's a whole city. And it was built up with the idea that this was going to be, the rubber facility that would supply the rubber for his product, but it was also going to be a place where people could live, people could go to school, people could have, their own hospital, they could have their own church, they could have whatever they wanted. Everything was going to be self-contained in this community, and it was going to be run by Henry Ford.
They also were required to live according to his very strict, hyper-idealized version of what good American life is.
Almost Puritan, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah, almost Puritan.
I mean, no
sure.
dancing, no music, that kind of thing. So,
right.
Yeah, he had some very strict rules if you were going to live in Fordlandia.
I think they could have ice cream. I'm serious. Yeah. I think they could play baseball and have ice cream.
Well, that's pretty good, right?
That's not bad.
Not a bad trade-off. Well, maybe it was.
I mean, I'm not out there cutting rugs anyway, so I'm not going to miss it.
But
it's a very strange community, especially when he was hiring locals and asking them to live a completely different life.
Yeah, and it wasn't long after this thing was built that the idea was given up. I mean, they decided
right.
that it wasn't going to work, but here the really strange part is that people stayed. People stayed for a long, long time thinking that something was really going to happen. It was going to turn around, that they were going to reopen this place. It was going to, the sawmill was going to reopen, the rubber factory was going to open again, and they were going to produce tires for, or at least the raw rubber, to send to Ford for his vehicle. So a really strange thing. It's a ghost town now, So you can go down and check it out. But again, it's in the Amazon rainforest, so not a lot of people make it there. You can, the good thing about, you know, being able to search on Google is that, you can find photos of this. You don't have to make the trip down there to see it, but I would love to see it in person someday. I really,
absolutely.
I really would. It's a long boat ride, I think, you know, once you land at the nearest airport, but,
right.
I would still love to make that trip and see what's going on in Fordlandia. It's an interesting place.
I think it would be absolutely worth it. Mm-hmm. We are going to conclude this list, but not necessarily today's show, with one last stop, and that is Italy.
Yeah, that was a big surprise to me. I just figured that Detroit was going to be number one. I thought that Packard factory was going to be number one, but this is one that I had forgotten about. This is the Bugatti factory in Italy. Now, in the town, okay, I'll try the town pronunciation here, and you tell me how I do, okay?
Okay.
Campogliano.
That's pretty good. I'm going to try to. Campogliano.
Close enough.
We
might have got it with one of those two.
You know, at some point, man, we're just going to have to break down and learn Italian.
This is where the famed EB110 was built. And a lot of people, now maybe, okay, you know what, I'm going to take that back. Not a lot of people, very few people have probably seen this factory, because I do recall somewhere, and I even read it somewhere, I didn't make a note here today, but I saw this factory in a magazine a long, long time ago. And it had a lot of photos of unfinished product just kind of left on the line. We're talking about Bugattis that were partially finished, parts of cars, machinery, offices that looked like they were just abandoned at a moment's notice, really. You know, there were things like cigarettes laying on desktops.
Yeah.
Really, really strange. I've seen these – I saw these photos in a magazine, and one of the commenters here on Jalopnik also had a link to a few photos from that magazine. And I neglected to write down the name of where it came from and all that, but you can find it pretty easy if you just check out this list. But this factory is really fascinating. Now, they, again, built that EB110 there, and the crazy thing is, like, how the factory was left initially. It was almost like they did have notice, but it's almost, again, like the case with the Alfa Romeo factory, where people just seemed to just leave things, just left it where it was and walked out the door. Mm-hmm. And really, really strange. There were things in this Bugatti factory, like, you know, near the lunchroom, you know, the cafeteria, they had the daily specials still written on a whiteboard outside of the cafeteria with the day's, you know, like soup and sandwich or whatever it was for whatever price.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah,
also,
still,
I'm hungry.
It was still there. There was a big viewing area that had, you know, a fully built car, what looked like a fully built car. It was probably incomplete, but it had that and a bunch of folding chairs set up as if they were going to give a press conference.
Yeah.
There was unfinished product on the line. As I said, there were just stacks of computers everywhere. We're talking about the old type with, you know, the big monitors.
Mm-hmm.
So those were lining the walls in one room. It was just a really, really strange situation. Papers everywhere. You know, some of them look like they were last-minute papers, like, you know, like things that could have maybe saved this factory. You know, the last-minute documents that were going back and forth, being faxed between, you know, the factory and lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
Just really, really fascinating stuff was left behind. And, again, it's just a strange thing to think about, but there were even marks on the floor for a product that they never built.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was supposed to be another model of the EB110 that was called the EB112 that they never built there. But they were laying out tape marks on the floor to say this is where we're going to build them. And mm-hmm. you know, suddenly, you know, the rug was yanked out from underneath their feet.
And, of course, Bugatti continues today. It's just not in Italy.
Yeah.
They're not in that plant.
Yeah, this weird plant is still left behind. And it's still – I think it's still empty today.
So – we were talking about this off air. We didn't want this to be a huge downer podcast. So I found something that I thought was an interesting piece of news.
What's that?
At least for U.S. factories. Well, it turns out that empty factories and warehouses have become objects of like high regard and high demand now. People want these structures. And this is a trend that we are seeing on both sides of the coast here and all across. Like, it makes sense in places that are, I want to say, real estate poor, where like land is at a higher premium. It makes sense that in like England or London especially, people would want to reuse every building they can.
Well, sure, you're living in one now, and we're podcasting from one right now.
Right, and I think this trend is spreading as more and more people live in cities. More and more of these old buildings are going to be revitalized rather than torn down.
Yeah, they're prime real estate. They're they're extremely solid built. You know, pieces of property.
Yeah.
So, and they often have features that, you know, I guess maybe property managers would really appreciate, you know, like things like extremely heavy-duty freight elevators like our building has.
Right.
I'm not going to say that you could, but you might be able to you know, lift a car in those things. They're enormous.
Dude, let's try it.
Yeah, maybe we should try it. But there's no doubt that they were to lift heavy appliances and machinery and things like that. So I would guess that you could lift a car in those things. A lot of property managers find some of these attributes very valuable. Again, you know, they're in prime locations. They've got a lot of windows. So, you know, you got great views of the city. It seems like it's a smart use of the space rather than tearing down the old stuff, reuse what's already there.
So don't let these abandoned factories get you down, because, ladies and gentlemen, the odds are that they will not be abandoned for long.
Yeah, or they'll be released by, like, leased again, I should say, by, the Board and Milk Company, or the American Natural History Museum will use it for storage.
Or a doll tycoon.
Yeah, you'll see. I mean, there's always a use for stuff like this, right? People need space for something all the time. So, all these factories probably could be put to use. Some are like the Packard factory. I think it's too far gone at this point.
Right. Yeah, that might be a different case.
But again, check out the news stories around that place. It's fascinating.
And remember, if you bring a tiger with you to a photo shoot, I think we can agree this is the moral of this episode. If you bring a tiger with you anywhere, you got to keep an eye on it, man.
Don't let it out of the harness or whatever you've got it in, right? I mean, that's a bad idea.
Keep your eye on the tiger.
And the guy caught it with a weed whacker and a tarp. Can you believe that?
I mean,
it's insane.
It sounds very MacGyverish.
It is.
I'd love to know the operation.
It's a big tiger, too. It's not like a baby either. So if that's what you're thinking, it's like a baby tiger, not the case.
It's not some tiny punk tiger.
No, check out the video. It's a big, scary tiger.
And so concludes our episode for today, as Scott and I go off to hit the road, or I think first I'm going to be watching a lot of weird stuff about Packard on YouTube. In the meantime, we would like to hear from you about the industry surrounding your neck of the global woods. Do you have any big, creepy abandoned factories? Do you have any cool urban exploration stories? Let us know. We'd like to share them with your fellow listeners, and we will not condone anything illegal, but we will also protect your identity if necessary. In the meantime, you can check out every episode Scott and I have ever done. I would specifically recommend one on Fordlandia on our website, carstuffshow.com. Check in with us on Twitter and Facebook to see some of the stories that, for one reason or another, might not make it to the air.
Don't forget DeLorean's story as well.
Oh, and don't forget, a DeLorean story as well. And if you have an idea for a topic we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear it. You can write to us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.